And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. This show is for February 11th, 2022. At this time, the global CO2 level in the world is 417.99 parts per million, and there are 2,880 days left until the year 2030. So recently, we've had been having a discussion about gas leaks, which of course are an important component in fighting climate change. Gas leaks of natural methane gas in the streets of the state of Massachusetts. There's been a recent study published that does this fascinating thing of taking the latitude and longitude of every leak, and that information has been provided by the utilities, overlaying that with census information about where people live in proximity to the leaks. And it's come to a fact that we probably should have suspected, that there are worse leaks and slower repair in communities that are disadvantaged in the state of Massachusetts. And that's not a good thing. We are honored to have with us today the two authors of that study to talk about that, make sure we get that story right, and then to talk about what the state can do about this observation. So we're happy to be joined today by Marcos Luna, who is a professor of geography and sustainability at Salem State University here in Massachusetts, and with Dominic Nicholas, who's a project director at the nonprofit called HEET, H-E-E-T, the Home Energy Efficiency Team. Welcome to you both, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So I told a little story about your paper as I tried to put your paper into 140 characters like a tweet. And I'm not sure I got there. Tell me, can you briefly summarize what you think the paper said, why you wrote it, and then let's talk about the sort of ideas of what can be done at a policy level.
So I don't know if I can do it in 140 characters, but so what we looked at was the distribution of gas leaks, the leaks that are on the gas services and mains that run underneath your roads to homes and businesses. And there were about over 26,000 in 2019. We looked at them where they were, and we compared their frequency of occurrence to the demographics, the population characteristics of people who live nearby. And we found that people of color, limitingly speaking households, lower income folks, were more often living near these leaks than the general population. And by contrast, white folks, older folks tended to live further away from them than would be expected. So this kind of confirms an expectation of a lot of patterns of inequality we see across the state. And we also saw that those leaks in those same neighborhoods were also older and repaired more slowly. So there's definitely an inequality of experience in these leaks in terms of their occurrence, but also in terms of their timely repair.
And so I think to put a point on it, you're saying this is a simple observation, right? This is just data. This just correlates where people live with the leaks. It doesn't go into any sort of judgment about why or what can be done, right? I mean,
that's right. We're not investigating the root causes of these different exposures, and we do recommend further study, but we're not trying to get at the root causes of these findings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean that's a good stance to take. But in terms of addressing, the way I would say it is, you guys have revealed what amounts to a civil rights issue. It's an inequity, in a systemic inequity in the way certain people are delivered this commodity that everyone needs, the methane gas to heat their home. But the repair and upkeep of that system is, by observation, not done fairly, right? Certain communities tend to not get repaired as quickly. So what sorts of stuff can the state do? What would be the steps to try and remedy that?
Well, maybe we can start with what is going right. So Massachusetts requires the utilities to report gas leaks to begin with. And the research was only possible because they reported that, and HEET did the major work of taking that data and making it accessible and mapping it and putting it out there. The state also has, so that's great. And, you know, we want that to continue. And unfortunately, Massachusetts is the only state in the country that we're aware of that has such a policy in action doing that. The other good thing that's going on is the state does have an environmental justice policy as part of its climate roadmap legislation just passed last year that defines environmental justice communities. So we have state policy that says you need to look more closely at these communities when you are looking at environmental permitting or other kinds of activities. And it also, the state is in the process of developing rules around cumulative impact analysis to look at when development happens that you're not adding to already burdened communities. So there's a lot of good infrastructure that's in place to build on and that, but there's always more to do. And as this analysis shows, we have a lot to dig ourselves out of.
One, just before we go too far, I mean, it's easy enough for to say environmental justice community. I think that the roadmap law specifically defines an environmental justice community as a place that has those low income, lower English language rates, because one of the big problems is having people understand, right? Literally understand these meetings, these citing meetings, right? So there are very specific criteria around what constitutes an environmental justice community, right?
Right. And the state's actually had a policy in place for the last 20 years thereabouts, but it's only in the last year that it was put into legislation. So now it's got the force of law to define it, but you're right. So essentially communities that have communities are census block groups, to be technical, that have more than 25% households who have limited English speaking capacity, more than 25% who are, or excuse me, if the communities, the median household income is less than 65% of the state median household income. And then if they have a high minority population, 40% or greater, or if they have 25% or greater, and they're also less than 150% of the statewide median household income. So,
curious, it's just so that I understand, this question comes in the moment, that environmental justice standard is not based on the presence of fossil fuel infrastructure now. Right?
Correct.
If you take a place like Peabody, which qualifies as an environmental justice community, it's not an environmental justice community because it has a peaker plant. It's an environmental justice community on its own definition that has nothing to do with the, shall we say, the burden that the community is carrying, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's not based on existing or any kind of particular numerical threshold for existing burdens. It's based on the history of the fact that these particular groups have been historically left out of planning or decision making, and from, you know, decades of research, this is kind of predictable when you find problems. And then the other challenge is that, you know, as our science gets better, we keep finding new kinds of risks that we didn't anticipate before. And what's funny about that, though, is that when you look at them, you tend to find that those risks are higher in those kinds of communities. So what we find is that being led by communities that historically have been, you know, victimized, marginalized, left out of the decision making, you will often anticipate problems that arise. So it's kind of a progressive way of approaching the problem, rather than saying, let's first identify environmental burdens and then see who's living there, which is important too, no doubt. This is just addressing that problem that we find is persistent inequality that is historic, but, you know, again, persistent.
And I would just, in case anyone's not familiar, a case in point, I think, is the East Boston Chelsea substation, right? With this, the one of the utilities trying to put in a big electrical infrastructure in that neighborhood. And all of the siting meetings, the community siting meetings, were conducted in English, and many of the people who live there don't speak English. And so it's just like a, you know, an unfair way to have, they weren't really involved. There's a specific case that at least I know about where this definition of the environmental justice community makes sense, right? That there should be special attention. I guess one other question I had is, if you said it's a good thing that the state collects all its utilities collect the leak data, So tell me, so we have the idea of the good things that we have, good data coming in from the utility on where the leaks are that we can work with. We have the infrastructure of identified environmental justice communities, right? So given those two things, what new actions would you recommend that the state do to try and modify the state of play now? What could they do?
Well, I think one thing that we explicitly say in the report, too, is that this could be applied to lots of things. It's not really just utility specific. And that's to say that an environmental justice kind of lens to be placed on, you know, development and planning and certainly utility infrastructure when decisions are made, to think about very carefully, how will this play out for marginalized communities, and how could we be proactive in doing things that will take care of those communities that are more vulnerable and less likely to benefit. I mean, so one thing to think about it, you know, because when we see results like this, where there's an inequality, particularly racial inequality, it makes people very uncomfortable, or certain people very uncomfortable to talk about it. And there's very nervousness about pointing fingers about who did what or whether it was intentional. And I think that may be important at some other conversation, but at the moment, this is just a fact on the ground. And so how do you address that? And so in this case, you know, it means doing things to prevent that outcome from happening. And so, for example, if, and I don't know that this is the case, but let's say that if a policy is to, an informal policy about addressing some proportion of leaks is to respond to communities when they complain, or residents when they complain, on the face of it, that's great. You want them to be responsive to community complaints. But if that is driving a large part of the response, what will happen with that is that you'll get an inequitable outcome, because certain kinds of people are going to know better about how to interact with the system and the bureaucracy, to reach out, to have the confidence to reach out, to have the language skills to do it. And so that's going to result in an unequal outcome, even though on the face of it, it looks relatively neutral. And so thinking through those kinds of things can really be productive in terms of trying to, you know, head off a problem that might occur later on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think in your report, you talked about, you know, prioritizing that environmental justice, somehow including the environmental justice recognition in your prioritization of how to fix leaks.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're suggesting, you know, we recognize already the utilities are prioritizing leak repair based on hazardousness. You know, is this a grade one that needs immediate repair because it presents an explosive hazard? There's already some prioritization criteria in place. You know, now we've brought in environmental impact of some of these leaks, you know, significant environmental impact leaks regulation. So that's another piece that utilities are already using. And what we're suggesting is now they can also start to think about bringing in, you know, environmental justice framework to also inform their prioritization process too. So I'm not saying throw out those other prioritization criteria, but just bring this in as well. Use that as another lens to figure out, you know, where to prioritize. So I think that's an important distinction. Again, we're not saying throw out your previous prioritization methods, but think about this too and bring this into your process.
I mean, the analogy of the metaphor of a lens is just, you know, it's one more perspective that you take when you look at your data and say, oh, yeah, this too. And then at some point that begins to carry its own weight. I guess one of the recommendations that I think is worth explaining that I believe is in your paper is the concept that there is a growing risk that as shall we say, just to mean well-to-do people put solar panels on their roof, get an induction in a heat pump, you know, all that kind of cool stuff. They electrify their homes. The customer base for the gas, the methane gas keeps shrinking, right? And that the people who are left on that shrinking island are the people least able to electrify their homes. Right. And so
you're incurring greater costs too. Yeah.
So tell me more about that. How should people understand that future risk of marginalized communities getting stuck paying for through their gas bills all of these repairs while all the other people who can afford to get a heat pump are no longer responsible for it, right? Isn't that the idea?
Well, I think I'll comment a little bit and I'll leave to Dom, but my perspective is we have to decarbonize, right? I mean, this is an imperative to get to meet our goals. And so there will inevitably be a reduction in the usage of gas along that way. And how that happens and how fast it happens is obviously a big question, but it means that, you know, it has to challenges the profit model for these utilities. And if what we're seeing so far is that, you know, wealthier households are the first ones able to buy solar panels, to buy the heat pump and to do those things. And so you'll have that shrinking ratepayer group who are left with gas, and they're probably going to be the lower income communities and folks. And so, you know, if the gas utilities, you know, if it's a struggle to keep up with the problems that are currently happening, let's just say leaks, in a period when there is, you know, significant investment and you've got more than half of households in the state buying gas, what will it look like in the future if you have a fraction of that customer base, you know, left on that system? You know, are the leaks going to get worse? Are there going to be the resources to invest in kind of upgrading the system? So, I mean, that's certainly one key question we have about what is this going to mean for those folks if we follow this model?
Yeah, I think it's something Heat's thinking about a lot as we're working on the geogrid too, because it's a similar question there, potentially regressive impacts. And, you know, recent discussion we were talking about, well, maybe you have a fixed energy cost to customers, and behind it you have a blend, you know, a different cost structure for gas and a different cost structure for renewables, but for everybody the cost is the same. So blending it behind the scenes, I'm not explaining it very well because I'm not, like, you know, quite in that zone, right, but right. that might be an interesting mechanism to kind of normalize the costs and avoid regressive impact. But I'm not fully fluent with that. I think Marcos is probably more fluent. We should bring some other people in from Heat for a discussion on this, that they spend a lot more time thinking about this than I have. But
I think, I mean, I guess the important thing, or my, in my own life, until I've heard something three times, the penny doesn't drop, right? And the third time, I get that now, right? So the first hint here is that there are potential inequities for marginalized communities as everyone moves off of gas, and that we need to begin to sort of have that in the back of our mind as we go forward, right? Super, super. Well, look, I congratulate both of you on having made an excellent paper, right, and uncovered something that is a juicy topic for people to think about and be aware. And I keep bringing up the fact that the state is on a 10-year campaign to implement the 2030 roadmap, right? And we're all involved in something that's going to take us 100 years as a society to get to fully decarbonize, right? So as we learn new things, we need to fold that. As we learn new things, we need to fold it back into our efforts. So this kind of report supports, you know, sane and sensible modifications to the roadmap, right? It's all the one package as the state and, you know, the species, I guess, moves to a decarbonized future. So I thank you very much for an interesting paper about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much.
What I'll do is I'll put up links at the blog. The blog will be at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can check out hot links there. If you have comments or questions, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. You're probably listening to us on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. I want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. So we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Marcos, Dominic, thank you so much for taking time to chat. It's been fascinating.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.